Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall and you're listening to the Downtime Podcast, where we delve deep into the gravity-based side of mountain biking. This week, the podcast is supported by Canyon Bikes and Smith Optics. Hopefully, you've already listened to last week's episode where we went behind the scenes of the new Canyon Sender. I've been lucky enough to borrow one for a few weeks, and this last week I got the chance to ride it at Revolution Bike Park in Wales and Adrenaline Uplift in Scotland. It's fair to say that the smile still hasn't left my face. The bike was faultless throughout and was so confidence-inspiring that it enabled me to ride faster than I ever have and to hit features that were previously off-limits to me. I've been blown away by just how good it really is. Canyon have kindly offered Downtime listeners free bike guard on all of their Gravity range globally until the end of August. So if you're thinking about buying a Spectral, Strive, Torque or Sender, then you can save yourself a bit of money. All you need to do is to head to canyon.com and use the coupon code DOWNTIME2020. That's the word DOWNTIME, all in capitals, followed by the number 2020 with no space. All the terms and conditions for this offer can be found in the show notes for this episode over on downtimepodcast.com. This episode is also supported by Smith Optics, and they were kind enough to hook me up with their new mainline full-face helmet for my downhill riding last week. It's a brand new full-face that is designed firstly as an enduro race helmet, which means it's insanely light and well vented. However, it's also DH certified, so it's safe to use for all your gravity riding. The helmet comes with three alternative cheek pad sizes, two different neck rolls and two crown liners, so you can perfectly tune the fit of the helmet to your head. And even better, those pads are antibacterial and made of a super soft and comfy material. Normally, when wearing a full face, I notice the added weight and also feel like my field of vision is restricted. Not with the mainline. It was as comfortable for me as riding in my regular trail lid. It stayed in place perfectly and didn't make any noise when riding like some full face lids can. I haven't yet worn it for a pedal up, but even from a warm day on the uplift, I can tell you that this thing is cooler than any full face I've worn in the past, so I'd happily use it for enduro racing or big days in rough terrain. You can check it out over at smithoptics.com/mainline. Smith have sent me a pair of their Ruckus riding glasses to give away, which is the same pair that I've been enjoying using for the last year. It comes with its own hard case, soft bag and two pairs of lenses for different light conditions. In order to be in with a chance to win, all you need to do is to follow at Downtime Podcast and at Smith Optics UK on Instagram and comment why you need some new sunglasses on the competition post, which will be going live at midday today, BST on both those channels. I'll be picking my favourite answer on Tuesday the 25th of August, so you've got until then to get your entries in. You can support the podcast by grabbing yourself a t-shirt over at downtimepodcast.com/shop. There's four designs to choose from. They're all 100% organic and made using renewable energy and shipped without any single-use plastics. As always, make sure you subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss an episode and get them as soon as they drop. It's free and it's super easy to do. Just head to downtimepodcast.com/subscribe and click the button for whichever platform is best for you. While you're there, you can fill out the form to join my newsletter, where I'll send you an email every Friday with some interesting bike-related things I've seen that week, along with links to any competitions we've got running and some insight into the products that I've been using and enjoying. All right, this week I'm joined by one of 2019's standout riders, Charlie Harrison. Charlie stood on the podium at the first and last rounds of the season and dealt with a wrist injury and an operation in the middle. We talk about his race career so far to find out how he's gone about becoming a podium threat. We talk teammates, relationship building, the importance of a good crew around you, sports psychology, faith, early nights, and plenty more. So, without further ado, here's Charlie Harrison. Charlie Harrison, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. How's things with you?
Thanks for having me on. I'm stoked to be here. Everything's great. Yeah, can't complain. Life is awesome. I'm very blessed, so happy to be here.
Excellent. Yeah, you were just saying you started the day with two coffees and a surf, so that sounds pretty good to me.
Yeah, pretty much my ideal morning setup. Got up pretty early and made a coffee, went for a surf, and then shared a coffee with a buddy after it. So, yeah.
Very nice. And you're quite into your coffee, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, I would say I'm pretty into it for sure, but in the grand scheme of things, I'm quite a beginner. I've learned everything from my coach Chris, so it's pretty funny. Like, he comes and stays with me every winter for a few weeks, and we do a bit of a boot camp. But that first winter he came over here, I pretty much hardly drank coffee at all, and then by the time he left, I was like super into it, and now it's just, yeah, one of my biggest passions for sure. But it's good. Like, it's just nice. Like, it's once you get to the point where you're getting ready for bed and you're just so psyched to wake up and make coffee in the morning. It's that's when you're at the point where you've unlocked it.
Nice one. Yeah, that sounds pretty good to me. Well, let's wind the clock back to start this thing off a little bit and tell us a little bit about your childhood, because I think you're another fast rider that came from a motocross background. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes, that's correct. My brother and myself, we raced moto for 8 years. I started racing when I was 5 and stopped right around that 12, 13 age. And it was awesome. I've talked about it with my parents a lot. They've worked so hard to give myself, my brother and my sister just the best life that we could possibly have. And I'm super grateful for that. I wouldn't change our childhood for anything. Racing moto was awesome. Instilled a lot of really just great lessons. And, the memories that we got to make were amazing. Right towards the end of it, we took a year off to kind of get our finances back, because as everyone knows, it's such a financially just big responsibility. So we took a year off to kind of get the family's finances back together. And then after that, it was kind of just like one of those things where it wasn't something that we really felt like we needed in our life anymore. I didn't miss it to the point where we felt it was super necessary. And I went back to racing a little bit after that. But that was pretty much the end of it. It was kind of fizzling out. So, just kind of the stereotypical motocross story, really. It takes a lot. And it's pretty easy to get burnt out on. But with that being said, I wouldn't change it for a thing. I'm very thankful for it. And, now that it's, obviously not my main focus, I actually enjoy riding motocross way more, and still use it a lot for cross training. So it's good.
Yeah, definitely. It's not a sport that is kind of contrary to mountain biking. It seems to help skills, getting comfortable at speed, strength, all that sort of stuff seems to work really well together.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you said, I feel like those two together really complement each other. There's a ton of really good motocross riders that are super talented on a mountain bike, and even guys that don't ride regularly, fast moto guys, they'll just go for a ride, and it's like they do it all the time, you know what I mean? So it's pretty cool, and it is really cool too how like the moto guys, like pro moto guys, are so psyched on mountain biking, and then vice versa. So everyone kind of shares a really good connection where they're really stoked on the other sport.
Yeah, that's cool to see, man. So yeah, how did mountain biking get into your life then?
Yeah, it was one of those things where my whole childhood, like I was super big into BMX and going to the beach and obviously racing moto. And then when that stopped, I was just doing, the rest of the things that were normal to me, riding BMX a ton and that sort of thing. And mountain biking was always like a really fun hobby to myself. And like, for example, when we would go up to Mammoth every year for the amateur national, we'd always do a few runs, just like on the trails that went down into the village from the bottom of the mountain. And those were super fun. It was always like a highlight of the trip. And then when I was really little, my mom used to shuttle my dad and my brother up to where you ride XC, but we were so young that we would just get shuttled up to the top and ride down. So it was always a huge interest of mine. And I always had a mountain bike. But with that being said, it wasn't like I stopped racing moto and I was like, right, the plan now is to start racing mountain bikes. It was always just a huge interest of mine. So like I said, I was just doing all my normal things and was a huge fan of mountain biking. And I saved up for, I don't know how long it was, a year, year and a half. And my mom was nice enough. She matched what I saved up and got a Scott Voltage freeride bike from the shop.
Nice.
And just started riding around here. Not even really trails, just like push trails, little, jump spots, that sort of thing. And then through meeting a friend at one of the spots, he invited me to go out to Fontana with him to do a race. And I did a clinic. My mom did some research and she found that Rich Hausman was doing clinics at the Fontanas. So I went and did the clinic with him that weekend, raced. And then that's the end of the story, really. It's, yeah. Now we're here. It's crazy. It's I'm pretty blown away by just the way things line up and the amazing people that I've had, you know, come into my life throughout the course of my career that have helped me a ton. And Rich is, I would be absolutely nowhere without Rich. He kind of, you know, from that first race, I guess he saw something in me and he took me under his wing and was with me all the way, until I got off the ODI development team. And even after that, like, he's still a huge supporter. So.
Yeah, that's really cool. I was going to ask you a bit about that, but first off, like, how did those early races go? Cause I look back at some of your older results and like some races seem to, they start racing and they just start winning straight away. And they obviously love that as a young child and that kind of drives them. Your first results weren't like that. It doesn't look like you kind of were straight in at the top. Tell us a little bit about those early races and how they felt to you.
Yeah, for sure. So the first race I did, I raced beginner and I won that race. So that was super cool. That was obviously like my first downhill race. But I think kind of just from moto, just having that, that lesson of like, if you want to get faster, you race with the fast guys. So I just went straight from beginner to expert class. Like I didn't do sport or anything, along those lines. So that was kind of just the thing where it was, you know, if you do want to get faster, you want to progress, just race the fast class and go from there. That was kind of, you know, what my parents were thinking as well as Rich. That's kind of just the plan we made. So, but yeah, like you said, it was a big step for sure. I think my first junior X race, was the Fontana City National, and back in those days that was like more of a high stress event than like say world champs or something. It's so funny. But I think I got maybe 21st out of 24 guys or something like that. So it was just go straight to the class and see what it's like and kind of go from there. And yeah, it was just slowly trying to build. It's funny, like throughout the course of my career, it's kind of like get to these steps and it's almost like a reset. And then you're like, well, okay, well, let's see what I can do from here. It was like a big goal of racing Junior X at Fontana was trying to get a top 10. And then you finally crack the top 10. And then it's like, all right, let's try and get on the podium. And then try and get a win, that sort of thing. So it's pretty funny. It's definitely just like a lot of steps, get to a point and then just have your mind absolutely blown with, you know, competition. And it's just like a whole change of perspective. And then try and go from there and reset and try and work, see what you can go for.
Yeah. So straight away then you were thinking about how to push yourself harder by the sounds of things, by moving up a class. Have you always been like that?
I don't know about intentionally. Obviously through moto, that was kind of the thing. And then I guess so. If you were to look back, it's kind of just, trying to see what I'm capable of. And I still feel the same today. You know, with racing, it's like, I'm certainly not done with my career. Cause I feel like I haven't done what I'm capable of, but I can't say like, I don't know exactly what that means. You know what I mean? I just want to get to the point where I feel like, okay, like that was the most amount of effort I could do. And I've to a certain extent tried to accomplish, accomplish what I'm capable of. So not to say that I don't, you know, that the effort is subpar of 100%, but, it's just like the greatest joy I get from racing is just seeing what I'm capable of. Cause it's actually crazy. Like as cliche as it is, like you never know what you're capable of until you try.
Very true.
So it's been a fun journey for sure.
Yeah, cool. So tell us a little bit about the ODI development team then. So that was a thing that Rich Hausman was running. And was Aaron Gwynn a mentor on that program for a bit as well?
Yeah, so Rich was if you were to put it, a role on team manager, he was the team manager. And then Colby Young from ODI was a huge backer of that as well, obviously from ODI. And Aaron was part of it as well, sort of as that, yeah, sort of mentor role. And it was awesome. I would, without that team, I would be absolutely nowhere. They gave us such a good platform just to grow and mature as a racer. You know, they racing my junior career here in the States, like it was as dialed as you could get without, you know, without it being a World Cup factory team. And they helped get me to the point where I was obviously doing all the US races here, chasing the pro GRT national champs, that sort of thing. And then obviously, they gave me the platform to be able to go over and race some World Cups and see what that was like.
Cool. What sort of stuff, like, what would you say were the biggest things you learned from your time with that team then?
There was a lot. Just maturing as a racer for sure. And then being under the leadership of Rich, that guy is so wise and has been in the sport for so long. He, obviously is just has so much knowledge to teach. And I just, he did a really great job of taking care of me and mentoring me and, pushing me along. So I'm very thankful for, Rich and the team and all that.
Yeah. Like the 2013 season, when I look back at your results, it seems to be when things started to fall into place with you and the results really started to come. You took a win, I think, at Sea Otter. You took national champs in your age category. You won pro GRT. Did you feel anything different then? Do you think there's something that kind of clicked, or is it just a natural progression?
I would say it was kind of just a natural progression. Things were kind of, I think at that point I was just maturing as a racer, kind of understanding a little bit of racecraft, that sort of thing, getting comfortable with, you know, chasing the Pro GRT, racing regularly, that sort of thing. But I think even looking back now, it's I definitely don't have it figured out at this point, but there was still a lot to learn back then. Racing the GRTs here in the States, I was fortunate to have a lot of success. And I kind of thought, I guess I had an unrealistic perspective as to how that would translate over to World Cup racing. And then if you see from the results, it was definitely eye-opening going over to Europe and trying to race World Cups. That was in 2014, but there was definitely a lot to learn.
Yeah. Am I right in thinking your first World Cup was Mont Saint Anne?
Yeah, Mont Saint Anne 2014.
Yeah. How was that then? First time at a World Cup, pretty gnarly track as well.
Yeah, it was wild. And I think looking back, like I said, I just had a bit of an unrealistic perspective. I was getting success here at the GRTs in the junior class, winning some races. I guess it would be a bit of an ego thinking that because I was able to do well in the States, I was going to be able to go to World Cups and do well there. And that was certainly not the case. It was just, it's just such a big jump. There's so many more variables going on, and, you know, when you have qualifying and all that sort of thing, it's a lot. I feel for the juniors that have to come and just transition to World Cup racing. And especially nowadays in the junior class, there's so much pressure to just go straight into the junior class and just start getting results. And in reality, it's insane how much you have to learn. And I have a lot of respect for all the juniors that are able to just go in and kind of just adapt really quickly and start knocking off results straight away. It's gnarly for sure. But Saint Anne, yeah, Saint Anne is such a gnarly track. It's my favorite track these days, and even back then I was super into it. But it was a wild experience for sure. I didn't even qualify. I crashed in qualifying, and that was just another one of those moments where you kind of get to this point, and it's like, wow, it's just your whole world is open, and you're like, okay, well, let's try and figure out how to, you know, just start working to try and figure this out sort of thing and see what you can do. But it was wild.
Yeah. So yeah, you dip your toe in the water, got stuck into your first few World Cups, and then into 2015, you moved on to the Trek test team, I think. How did that come about? I didn't even know that existed, to be fair.
Well, so the first year I was on ODI, it was Gwynny's last year on Trek. So we were on Trek. Uh-huh. And then we did 2 or 3 years on Specialized while he was on Specialized. And then, so through being that first year on Trek, I just obviously made some relationships. And then Cole Piccettino's dad, Terry, he was the team manager, if you were to put a role on the team, at the Trek test team. And obviously just through racing, had a good relationship with him and got on there. And Jose Gonzalez was part of that team as well. He's a suspension engineer for Trek here. He has a race shop here in California. He's a mad scientist. But yeah, that he kind of helped me through that as well. And then, yeah, I mean... I can't really remember exactly how it all came about. But yeah, just basically talking with Terry and that sort of thing, just got it lined up. And it was, yeah, that was another really amazing program that helped me get to where I am today.
So you were kind of racing for them, but you were also testing a lot of components for Trek and Bontrager at the time. Is that right?
Yeah, for sure. So it was an in-house Trek team. And it was really cool because they gave us amazing support and, you know, Terry did a great job, dealing with the sponsors and kind of facilitating product and that sort of thing. So it was a really good combination of having a lot of support, but at the same time, giving that experience to kind of the other side of racing where you're, you know, designing and kind of developing products for the future. So that was really cool. I think that kind of just instilled a passion for testing and developing things for myself. That's something I really enjoy these days, and always kind of have enjoyed. And it really helped establish some amazing relationships within Trek, just, you know, through all the different sorts of people that we were interacting with through Trek, you know, whether it's the wheel guys or the tire guys, that sort of thing. So
yeah, picking up on a couple of things you said there, then the importance of that testing experience. Not many juniors, I guess, get the opportunity to do a load of product testing. Do you think that has helped in your career latterly, that you've had that experience of, you know, hopping on different bikes or different forks or whatever it happens to be?
That's a great question. I would like to think so, for sure. I feel like I'm decent at testing a product and kind of relaying my thoughts and feeling it. But it's pretty ironic because I'm one of the guys that will hardly change the setup. So like I'll get a setup and pretty much run it for the entire season. So it is pretty funny in that sense. But like I said, I think the biggest part of it was just through the test side, being able to establish so many relationships with different sorts of people, you know, whether it was the Fox guys or the guys at Trek, you know, through all the different teams in Trek and products, that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's the second thing I was going to pick up on, that you mentioned a few times, the relationships that you created along the way. How important has that been to you? And do you think people pay enough attention to that? Because it's a very small industry, really.
Yeah, for sure. I know relationships are huge, and especially with, like you said, how small this industry is. It's almost a given that, you know, if you part ways with someone, you're probably going to end up working with them in the future to some extent. So relationships are huge, and I've been very blessed with the people that I've been able to form relationships with, and I've had some amazing people that have really helped me out a lot, support wise and just mentorship and that sort of thing.
Yeah. What advice then would you give to younger riders that are that are getting into the industry, dipping their toes in the water and starting to meet people, like how did you approach building good relationships that have ultimately ended up helping you get where you are?
Oh, I would say, I think the biggest thing is just initiating it. It's real. I mean, and I can totally respect the fact that it's hard to go and introduce yourself to someone that you don't know. I'm quite a private person and quite an introvert. So that was a big thing for me. You know, it's hard to, when you're a junior on the World Cup circuit and you're trying to get a factory ride, like, you know, sending an email with a TM and them saying like, oh yeah, I'd love to meet you. And like actually going and talking to that person in the pits is, it's definitely pretty daunting. But like I said, I feel like we're very blessed in the World Cup scene, where I feel that most people generally want to help others. And it's cool. You'll see like teams helping out each other, or, you know, whether it's a privateer that shows up to the race and his bike didn't make it, everyone will kind of pitch in parts like that. Like everyone's really trying to help each other. And I think just starting the conversation is a huge part of it, especially too, when you're a junior. If you get a good result and a team manager can put a face to that result and, oh, you know, that kid was super polite and respectful and he took the time to come introduce himself to me, I think that goes a long ways.
Yeah, good advice for sure. So yeah, 2015 then, you're with the track test team and you had your first couple of World Cup podiums in I guess what would have been your second year junior. How did it feel to get those kind of results?
Yeah, so I'll have to downplay it. They weren't podiums. I got 2 fourths that year. So unfortunately, I wasn't able to actually get on the podium.
Is it a 3-rider podium for juniors?
Yeah.
Ah, I didn't realize that.
Yeah. So it was good. I felt that I was kind of getting, you know, towards that area of where I felt I should be. You know, that first top 10 was a huge milestone for me. And then St. Anne, I got fourth. So that was my first top 5. That was huge as well. And then I was able to get a fourth at Wyndham, the following weekend. So, but if you look back at it, like I really didn't do anything in my junior career. Those are pretty modest results. But like it was good for sure. They were, like I said, in my mind, they were big milestones, and just to be able to kind of crack into that realm was huge for myself. And that year was definitely a lot better as far as just feeling more comfortable at the World Cups.
Yeah, and it's a leap then, like you say, from junior to elite. How did you personally approach that? Like, how did you set yourself up for it? What expectations did you have of yourself
going from 2015 to 2016?
Yeah, making that move into the elite ranks.
Oh, I don't know. It was, I mean, I feel like it's just the natural order where when you're in your second year of junior, you're kind of, you know, comparing your times to pro times. Even though you're in your second year junior, the biggest thing on your mind is that first year elite. So looking back on it, I can't really say like this was the plan. You know, this is what I wanted to do. It was kind of just go into it and see, you know, see how well we can gel and adapt to it and that sort of thing. And obviously, if you look at results, it definitely was another one of those moments where it's just eye opening. Going from racing junior World Cups is really gnarly, and then your first year lead is insane. So it was a big learning experience, that's for sure.
Yeah, Fort William, I think, was your first elite World Cup, yeah?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, and didn't quite go to plan?
No, that was, crash and qualifying, and that was one of those moments. I mean, I called my mom after, and I was like, look, I'm done with this. Like, I'm putting all this effort in, and I can't seem to get it to go my way. Like, I felt like I was just doing so much and not seeing any return of it. It was just one of those really tough points in my career where I just didn't really see the light at the end of it. And I'm very lucky, very thankful that I was able to push through it. But yeah, that first year racing elite World Cups was a lot to take in.
And what was it that kept you going then? If you've been as low as wanting to kind of quit the sport or quit World Cup racing, what kept you going?
I think it's just the nature of myself to try and just, like I said, one of the biggest motivators for me is just seeing what you're actually capable of. And it was just one of those things where, you know, it would have been easier in the moment to quit than, you know, just stick with the process and keep working and see what you can do. So I was thankfully, you know, I had such a great support team around me with my girlfriend and my friends and my family, obviously. So I'm very thankful that I was able to be surrounded by the people that I was and still am today.
Yeah. Well, it looks like it worked, because by the end of that season, you were taking 14th place at Vaunord and then 14th at World Champs. What do you think changed from the start of the season to the end of the season? How did you tackle that journey through your first elite season?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I can't really, you know, put a statement to it. As you saw at Fort Bill, I didn't qualify. And then the next World Cup I raced was Lenzerheide, and I qualified, I think it was 78th, so just snuck in. Okay. And then I finished 45th in finals, which I was pretty stoked on. Yeah. And then the next World Cup I raced was St. Anne, and that was probably the biggest shift of confidence for myself, because I qualified, I think it was 19th, so top 20 quali, and that was one of those things where it was like, I completely was not expecting it. I just, you know, did my qualifying run, came down and saw that, and I was like, holy heck. I was like, yeah, I can retire after today, that sort of thing. Like, it was such a big deal to me. And then I finished 23rd in finals, but that was definitely a big confidence builder for myself. And there was just a lot of good things happening at that point. Getting the result, and then through my relationship with Trek, and then the Athertons being with Trek, they both kind of agreed to let me pit with them at Andorra and Worlds, which was huge. Having that support, I had a mechanic and that sort of thing, and just having that support was unreal. And that really helped me to get those two results at the end of the season. But it was kind of one of those things where it was just that roll of confidence, sort of. And at that point, there was no pressure, because I wasn't one of the guys at the World Cup scene, so there was not much to lose. And it was one of those things where it was, you know, confidence was building, and everything was kind of just coming naturally, which was amazing. And it was a really good experience. You know, it was just a whole lot of gratitude for myself, being able to be in those positions that I absolutely did not think were tangible or, you know, expected of myself. It was really cool just to be able to be in that position. And, you know, back then and now, like, I still look up to so many of the fast guys I'm racing against. It's insane how talented everyone is on the World Cup hill. But to be racing against so many legends and guys that I had watched videos of for so many years, it was just really cool to kind of be in the mix with some of my heroes.
Definitely, man. That's awesome. Did pitting with a team like Atherton Racing help you feel maybe more like you belong, like get rid of some of that imposter syndrome and help you feel like you have a place there and that you deserve to do well? Do you think that helped?
Yeah, for sure. I wouldn't say that I felt like I deserved to do well. It was more so, I would say that, like I said, like, it was kind of just that positive roll of events, and things were building and I was getting some better results. But like I said, them being gracious enough to give me that pit space and support for those two races was huge, because as a privateer at World Cups, it takes so much effort. And I have so much respect for the privateers, because it's insane, you know, how much World Cup racing takes out of your equipment, out of your body, out of your mind. So just, it was that first time where I was actually able to just, I just showed up to the track and rode my bike. And that was the only thing I had to worry about. You know what I mean? I didn't have to worry about breaking parts and trying to fix it, or, you know, getting my forks rebuilt, or, all right, practice is done, I got to wash my bike, rebuild it, you know, do recovery, eat, go to bed, that sort of thing. It was just like, it just simplified my life so much. And having that support definitely was another confidence builder for sure, because they, you know, if they were willing to help me out, it was really big in my mind, and definitely gave me a bit of confidence that if they're willing to put effort into me, I am able to do, you know, get some solid results.
Yeah. And is it true that you actually had an offer to join the Atherton racing team at the end of that 2016 season?
Yeah. Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah. And so you had an offer on the table from Intense as well at that time?
Yep. Yeah. So that was another crazy experience in my career. It was the first time I'd had offers, and, you know, had to weigh out options. And basically what it came down to is I felt that the team at Intense, you know, where I was at in my career, I was still so young and really didn't know how to race World Cups at all. I was still so new to racing World Cups. I just felt that the program at Intense with the teammates that I was going to have, was a much better place for me where I was at in my career, you know, as age, as a racer, that sort of thing. I felt that at that point in my career, it wasn't the best decision for me to hop onto such a top tier team, and have to deal with, you know, the pressure that comes with being on a top team like that. Not to say that, you know, I was downgrading Intense or anything, but like I said, I just felt that where I was at as a racer, Intense was a better platform for me to build upon and learn from.
Yeah, I guess it was a slightly, a younger, less proven group of riders than the Athertons were at that point in time with Dean and Jack. And it looks like you guys had an awesome time. Like that team for those couple of years looked like it had an amazing vibe.
Yeah, it was. I'm so thankful for those 2 years on Intense. The memories that we made and just how much fun we actually had was insane. You know, those two guys are some of the most genuine, kind-hearted people ever. And then even that first year on Intense, we had Nick Nesteroff, who's one of my best friends here in America. And it was just, so many memories were made, and it was a great place to build on and kind of figure out what I wanted and didn't want from a race program. And I just tried to be a sponge from Jack and Dean. You know, those guys both had, even before the team, they had a lot of success. And obviously 2017, Jack just absolutely crushed it. So it was a great program. And like I said, I wouldn't change it for the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Looking at results. So 2017 was, I guess, a little bit up and down for you. You had some top 20s, I think, at Lenzerheide and Val d'Isol. Were you happy with that season? And what did you look to change up? You talked about, you know, looking at those guys and working out what you wanted in a race package for you. What kind of things at the end of that season did you think, right, here's what I need to work on or what I need to change?
Yeah, it was another thing, because like I said, in 2016, there was nothing expected of me. There wasn't anything to lose. And then signing my first factory contract, you know, you're like, right, I need to perform. And I was still so young. So racing, doing that full World Cup season was a huge culture shift for sure. And it was the first time I'd ever done a full World Cup season in general. So just the travel, you know, being over there for so long away from family, racing all the World Cups, and then, you know, being on a factory team for the first time, feeling like, you know, you do need to produce results. It was a lot. It was a really good learning year for sure. I would say majority of the year, no, I definitely wasn't satisfied with how I was doing.
Okay. And so what does the process look like at the end of a season like that? How do you decide what you personally need to change or implement to go where you want to go with it?
Yeah, like I said, it was a great year to kind of just bank knowledge from. first year racing a full World Cup season. And after it, it was the first time I had had all the information to really reflect on and then try and build from there. I would say, yeah, the biggest difference between 2017 and 2018 was, one, having a full World Cup season under my belt. And then after 2017, I started working with Chris Kilmary, and that was a huge, huge part of my program. And he is literally the backbone of how I've gotten to where I am today. I felt like where I was at in my career, I was able to match it with the training side of it, of, you know, everything behind the races that was going into it. So that was a huge confidence builder, and he's taught me so much, and really I've got to give so much credit to Chris for helping me get to where I am today.
So has that just been in the physical side of things, or is there a lot more to what Chris offers?
For me, he offers a lot. I mean, with all his athletes, but he is a lot more to me, you know, than just a coach. Obviously he's riding all my programs. He's my riding coach. He's at all the World Cups. You know, he's raced World Cups. He understands the whole process of it. He's an amazing bike rider. So he just has so much more context to understanding what is actually required of us when we're doing our job. But to me as well, he's, you know, one of my best friends, and he's someone that I really, am open with sharing my feelings, how I'm feeling at a race, you know, just life in general. I feel like a lot of times I'm pretty closed off, and I like to keep my feelings and my thoughts to myself. But Chris is one of those guys that I'm fully transparent with, and he's always there for me, you know, whether it's across the board, whether it's, training or, you know, dealing with the stresses of racing, that sort of thing.
Yeah. So what made you choose Chris? Did you know him much before you took him on?
We knew each other for sure. I wouldn't say, you know, super great. 2017, before Fort William, I stayed with Greg Williamson for a few weeks leading up to it, and he was training with Chris. And so Chris came out for a bit of that time, and then that was really where we really connected for the first time. Before that, you know, it was one of those things where, like, we knew who each other were, but we weren't connected on a personal level. But through that season, he kind of helped me with a few things over in Europe. Like he does with anyone that, you know, regardless if you're training with him or not, he's always willing to give out some knowledge or help you if there's something that needs to, be addressed. So after that season, it was kind of, that was just what made the most sense to me. Like I said, I had started to build a relationship with him. Greg was training with him, and he had an amazing season that year. And Chris has so many great athletes. It was definitely, he definitely has a result proven program. So I think through the results that he had, the roster that he had, and then through the personal connection, it was just, you know, what made the most sense to me.
Yeah. Feels like it's been a good decision, and it started to show. Whether it was, that was the only change, but 2018 was a much more consistent season for you. I think most of the races you ended up inside the top 20. Did it feel different? Did it feel good? Like, when, what was it? Was it just a confidence thing or a strength thing? Or
yeah, there was a lot of good things that off season. Obviously training with Chris, and then I got the M29. There was a few prototypes floating around the year before, but I didn't get one. So that bike was, you know, much better. So, you know, way better bike, RockShox. That was when they did all their new suspension. So there was, from the performance side, it was a huge step forward. And then training with Chris was awesome. You know, just that was insane. You know, what it was such a big jump. As far as training programs. And like I said, I felt like that was where I was wanting to be in my career. That was a program that matched where I wanted to be, you know, as far as just what's required of the athlete. So with all those things, there was, just a real positive buildup. And I think just having a full World Cup season under my belt, kind of knowing what to expect to some extent, was all those things together really played a huge factor.
Yeah. And how then from there did the move come about to Trek Factory Racing? Because, I mean, I guess the intense thing was all significantly changing with Aaron taking on the team and different riders coming into place. How did the move to Trek come about, and how significant has that move been for you and for your racing?
Yeah, that move was, as you said, there was a lot of changes going on with Intense. And when I kind of thought of, you know, what I would want as a race program, who I would want to work with, based on my previous experience with Trek, it really, every time I kind of had that conversation in my head, it always came back to Trek. And I had left on a really good note at the end of 2016 when I obviously didn't take the offer that they gave me with the Athertons. But I had maintained really good relationships with them, and I felt like I left on a good note. We were, you know, they understood my point of perspective, and just maintained relationships throughout that kind of year and a half. And I just reached out, you know, pretty early in 2018 and just let them know that, you know, they were ultimately where I wanted to end up. So kind of just throughout the 2018 season, just kept in regular contact, and obviously it worked out. And I'm very thankful for the fact that they took me back. It was kind of like a coming home to moment. Just for them to, you know, understand where I was coming from when I didn't choose to go with them, and take me back, was something that I'm very grateful for. And this program is literally everything I could want and more. It's such a great mix of professionalism and support, without feeling like that. I think anyone is comfortable, you know, in the World Cup pits, coming over and hanging out in our pits, and everyone's always smiling and having a good time. So it's that great mix of just having absolutely everything you need to do your job. But it doesn't feel like you're on some top tier team where you just absolutely have to perform, and that's the only thing that they're worried about. I feel like there's a lot more context to that with Trek. Everyone feels like family. And yeah, they just, praise to them, because they literally give us everything we could possibly want and need to do our job. But I don't feel any pressure from them as far as the performance side.
Yeah, that's really cool. And Tracy Mosley's involved in that, I think, is she is like athlete liaison. Has that been a helpful addition to the team?
Yeah, for sure. It's someone with her knowledge is great to have around the races. Just someone that's been through it, and just another set of eyes on the track to help us out. It was really helpful that the races that she was at.
Yeah. And how's it been working with Reese and Kate? Because it looks like you guys hit it off pretty quickly.
Yeah. So obviously the biggest thing that I was bummed about leaving Intense was leaving Jack and Dean. I was like, man, I'm, you know, those guys are some of my best friends, and they will be for, you know, a lifetime. And I was just like, man, I don't know if I'll be able to get a team that feels like that. And straight away with Trek, it was insane, like how quickly we gelled. You know, first hour at team camp that December here in California, it was literally like we had been on a team together for 3 years. I'm very thankful that that the team atmosphere is so similar to Intense. And those guys are unreal. Between Cade and Reese and Ethan, we're just constantly laughing and having a good time. And there's a really good mix of personalities, which is really refreshing, because you could kind of, everything you want from a personality, like it's there at some extent within our team. You can pretty much find whatever kind of humor or just personality that you would want.
That's awesome. Yeah, it always looks like you guys are having a lot of fun, and it seems to be working. So 2019, straight out of the blocks, and you took fourth place at Maribor. You stood there on the podium with a bunch of very fast racers. How did it feel?
Yeah, it didn't. It's crazy. Like it literally was so numb, the experience. There was no way that if you told me 2 years ago that I was going to get a podium, like I would tell you you're crazy. And it's not, I had no idea coming in. Like I was not expecting that of myself. It was one of those things where everything kind of just lined up and I felt like, you know, God gave me such a great opportunity and it just worked out. And I was, the biggest thing I took from it, I was just thankful. It was kind of like 2016 where, you know, I'm battling with my heroes and, you know, to be standing on a podium with Loic and Troy, and I think Danny was on the podium as well, and Matt Walker, like it was, I was just thankful. And it was really cool. Loic's been a huge, just a role model of mine. And he's helped me out throughout my career. And to be able to share that first podium and have him be like so excited for me was really cool. Like I have a picture of us behind the podium, and that's definitely one of my favorite photos from racing. It's a great experience. And I was, like I said, I was just super thankful for the opportunity to be battling with the best guys in the world and to be on Trek. Everything was just, it was an awesome weekend for sure.
Nice. And we moved on from there to Fort William, and unfortunately things didn't go so well that weekend for you. Talk us a little bit through kind of what went on and then how you process a result like that coming from the highs of Maribor to what I assume are the lows of Fort William.
For sure. And last season was just a constant roller coaster of those emotions. And that was kind of the first time I had really needed to deal with that. And it took a big toll on me mentally for sure. And I honestly couldn't tell you really what happened in Fort William. You know, showing up with the four plate, there's obviously added pressure for that. But at the end of the day, I just didn't do my job. But I can't really put a finger on it. I think the biggest thing I struggled with last year was expectations that I placed upon myself. And I would assume that, you know, based on reflecting on Fort William, I was kind of just putting too much pressure on myself to perform. And in reality, it just made me perform way less. But yeah, it was, you know, time training went well. And then I flatted in qualifying, and then race run, I blew off track, and then really just didn't do my job. Just failed the race run really. And that was one of the toughest moments of my career for sure. I had like a full, I was so bummed after, just, I had a massive breakdown. Like I was crying. I just felt I feel it's really easy with racing to, kind of place your value as a human based on your results. And I think it's important to kind of, after the race, obviously you're going to have emotions, positive or negative, but you know, after that race day, you got to realize that racing is just something we do. It's not who we are. So that's always something that I've put an emphasis on. There's a lot of other things that I'm passionate about life. And like I said, racing is something that I love. I'm so thankful for the life that it's given me, but it's not who I am as a person. So at the end of the day, regardless of how I do in finals run, that's not who I am as a person. So I think I was just, as much of a blow as it was, I think I was kind of just able to take confidence in that. And then with those double weekends, it does make it pretty easy in the fact that, regardless of how the previous weekend went, good or bad, before you know it, you're kind of already into the next race process. So, you know, it's track walk day, that sort of thing. And you're already thinking about finals day that Saturday or Sunday.
Yeah, well, you turned it around pretty nicely for Lear Gang. I think fourth in time training, 25th in qualies, and seventh in the race. But before we talk about your race run, you had a crash in final practice, didn't you, I think, which left you more injured than you thought at the time.
It's so funny, like the massive stacks you have, like that never gives you the injuries. It's just always the dumbest crashes. So I literally slid out in the slowest, most awkward corner on the track and just put my hand down, and at first I thought my thumb was like tweaked. That's where I thought the pain was, and didn't really think much about it. I was like, obviously jammed my thumb a little bit, or, you know, whatever it was. Yeah, just kind of went through the day. But that race day morning was like such, it was probably the worst practice I've ever had before finals run. Like, I crashed 2 out of 3 runs. Yeah, went down and thought, you know, my hand was a bit sore. Went down to the pits or whatever, took some ibuprofen and got ready for race run. And I started to notice it when I was kind of pedaling around on my bike up top before finals, like bouncing on my bike and that sort of thing. I was like, man, this thing's like a little sore, but honestly, like, I didn't notice at all on my race run. It's so easy for, you know, how tunnel vision you get and how focused you are, everything else kind of just goes out the window. So fortunately I didn't feel it at all, in finals. And then that night when I was going to bed, it was one of those things where I was like, oh, when I wake up in the morning, like, this thing's going to be pretty sore. And then sure enough, woke up that next morning and it was pretty swollen. It was already swollen that night before, but yeah, pretty swollen and could hardly use it. Like, I couldn't hold my coffee grinder or that sort of thing, or touch my my thumb to my pinky. And I didn't think it was really injured. I was like, whatever, I sprained my wrist. And the plan was to go race Innsbruck Crankworks that next weekend. Uh-huh. So I was like, oh, whatever, give it a few days of rest, it'll be sweet. And then got to Innsbruck and it wouldn't get better. And I was still holding on to the fact that it was just sprained or tweaked. And then I went for a trail ride. We did a massive trail ride on Innsbruck, and like, I literally couldn't ride down, just pedaled up the fire road, rode down the fire road. And that was like, right, like, there's something actually wrong with this wrist. So that's why I went straight back to the pits and then got on the phone and was just talking with the team and was like, yeah, we made the decision that it was in my best interest to fly home and get it figured out. That way, if there was an injury, I could get a jump on it before Andorra. I was still thinking like, it's just a bad sprain, or, you know, maybe something's just, you know, just a little chip or something like that, like 2 weeks in a splint, it'll be good to go. And then went home and got it checked out, and yeah, broken scaphoid and needed to get surgery. So in reality, it was, you know, that surgery is so minuscule. It takes the doctor maybe 20 minutes. But yeah, man, these wrists just are so easy to snap. It's so easy with mountain biking, just to the natural instinct to just put your hand out. And yeah, that scaphoid is so easy to break. So I was super fortunate. Like, the way it broke was probably the best case scenario. You know, it wasn't at any of the distal ends. It was a clean break. It was in the middle, where the biggest issue with scaphoid is the blood flow to it. That's why it's so easy for them to die. And that's like the biggest worry about, you know, not enough blood flow going to it, it not healing, and then it dying. So luckily, yeah, it was non-displaced and it had decent enough blood flow. So it was, I think I was back on the bike in maybe 6 weeks, but wow. I missed the 2 races. And that was really the first time where I had an injury in my career where I was at home missing races. And it was definitely frustrating for sure, because there was obviously those first 3 races were a mix of emotions. And between, you know, Maribor and Fort William, how much of a contrast that was. And then I was really proud of myself to be able to bounce back at Leogang. And I was like, sweet, like, I'm, you know, I'm back where I should be. And I was excited to kind of keep that momentum going. And then, you know, to go home and have to realize that I'm going to be missing races and seeing that overall go out the window, that was tough for sure. I was definitely very cranky and pretty bitter. And I could not stand to see anything race related. I came down one of the mornings, my mom was watching Leger finals, and I was like, you better turn that off right now. Like, I just wanted nothing to do with it. Yeah. So, luckily, though, in the grand scheme of things, I can't complain, because I was able to get back on the bike, you know, fairly quickly, and it could have been a much worse injury for sure.
Yeah, and you definitely got back up towards back up to speed towards the end of the season with the 13th at Monsanto Worlds, which is a very good result in itself. But then we head over to Snowshoe for the final race of the season, and you get the opportunity to compete on home soil. First off, how did it feel getting to race in front of your home fans?
Oh my gosh, Snowshoe! Like, I hands down could happily retire after that weekend. Just it didn't feel like a race at all. It was just, it was so cool. Like, even with my practice, I felt like I wasn't at a World Cup practice. Like, I was just riding, and all weekend, like, riding with my friends, I was following people, and it was just so much fun. And obviously being in front of the home crowd, every time you went past anyone on the track, like, they were just so psyched for you and cheering. And the fans at Snowshoe are so in tune to racing. It was incredible, because Snowshoe is such a logistic nightmare. It's so far from any major city. Like, pretty much any city that you're going to go to, is it's going to be a 4-hour drive to Snowshoe. So anyone that was at Snowshoe fan-wise, like, actually wanted to be there and, you know, took a lot of effort to be there. And everyone, pretty much all the fans, knew every single rider, all the, like, where they were in the overall, if this person was protected or not. It was such a cool experience. You know, aside from the result, just being able to be in that atmosphere at home is incredible. And then obviously the weekend went really well. But man, I got to give it up to the fans. Like, it was such a humbling experience. Never in my wildest dreams would I have thought that many people would be that excited to see me do well. You know, all day after finals, like, just USA chants for the remainder of the afternoon. Like, the podium was insane. And yeah, just, I was so humbled by it. Getting to interact with everyone and just seeing how excited they were for me was something that I'll forever cherish.
Yeah, man, it was an amazing weekend. And you took fastest in time training, qualified third, so you sat up the top of the hill with only two riders to drop behind you. The entire USA, it feels like, trackside, probably. How did you deal with the pressure of that situation?
Yeah, I don't know, to be honest. It was good that everything on the weekend was just building upon itself. You know, I did well in time training, and I was like, yeah, okay, cool. But you know, time training is one of those things where you got to take confidence in it, but at the same time, it's only time training. And then qualifying went well. So it was kind of just like, just sort of building on itself. And I was confident in myself. That was, Snowshoe was amazing in the fact that it was the first time ever that I've been up at the top before a race run and actually believed in myself, like, I could actually win a World Cup right now. Uh-huh. And that was such a cool experience. But yeah, just, there was just so much positive pressure going around. I think that was the biggest thing. And just feeling comfortable at home, you know, starting to build back up to where I felt like I wanted to be or where I was at pre-injury. That was really good. Yeah, and then all these things and just being at home with the fans, it was so cool. I remember, like, when I was in the start gate for race run, you know, you typically stand up, you're sitting down spinning, and then you usually stand up, like, I mean, every rider is different obviously, but you know, either 10 or 5 seconds before you're going to go, you kind of get in that sprint position. Like, as soon as I stood up off the bike, guys in the first section were just going crazy up top. So it was just like one of those things where there was a lot of positive pressure and I was just really excited to try and perform.
And it worked.
Yeah, it was awesome. Yeah, like I said, coming back from injury, being able to spend that last World Cup in the USA, getting an amazing result, kind of just having all those emotions from a World Cup season flood out, and being able to lead into the off season with a good result, it was incredible, and everyone was just, yeah, so excited for me. It was I'm very, very thankful for Snowshoe.
Yeah, man. So what do you think it will take then for you personally to find that consistent speed week in, week out to be up there with riders like Troy, Loic, Amory, Danny on a regular basis?
Yeah, for sure. That's something I'm trying to figure out. And I got to give massive respect to those guys. It blows my mind how they're able to just constantly perform. It's definitely something that I'm trying to reach for. And like I said, that was the biggest thing last year was me just dealing with the mental side of racing and dealing with the personal expectations that I place on myself. I think, you know, looking back on 2018, where I was pretty consistent with top 20s, and I feel like I've throughout the course of my career, I've been fairly consistent. So 2018 was really good consistency wise. And then 2019 was obviously a massive change. And I think reflecting on that, the biggest thing was just how hard it is to get a top 10 World Cup result. Like, those guys are so fast and you have to ride the edge so hard. I think that the biggest factor for that was that you have to push so hard, and in order to get those results, you're riding that limit, and it's so easy to, you know, overdo it and, you know, crash or, you know, make a massive mistake. So the room for error is a lot higher. And then obviously dealing with the personal expectations. But I've got a sports psychologist that I've been working with for quite some time now. And we've, been working on a lot of good things. His name's Alex Hodgins. So I've been working with him, and then we've been working with Chris, kind of just as a team, going over some things. And it's just been really cool because, you know, it's so easy as an athlete to do all the training, and it's so easy to just overlook the mental side of it, which is, you know, some may argue it probably is the most important side of it. And it's been obviously a super weird year with everything that's going on. Not many races, but I was super fortunate to be able to go do two US races a little over a month ago, and just being able to kind of use some of those things that we've been working on and put them into practice was really good. Because before, you know, when I raced the first Pro GRT of this year, it was like 9 months or something since snowshoe, so that was a massive gap of time.
Well, and you put massive gaps of time into the rest of the field at both those races. I think you were like 4 or 5, nearly 6 seconds up on second place at both of those. So you're obviously in a good place right now. Yeah? Do you think the mental side of things and the coaching you've been working on there has been a big part of that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, like I said, it's just so easy to kind of overlook those things. And that, I mean, I'll be fully transparent. Like, that was my biggest struggle last year, was the mental side of it, just being able to perform when I needed to. And I feel that the things that I've been working on have been super beneficial. And there's, you know, little things that I've picked up on, you know, from these past two races that I've done, where in the past would have been a big issue to me, you know, whether it's crashing or having a bad practice run, that sort of thing. I feel like one of the biggest things I noticed was I was just really enjoying the process of it. Like, the whole racecraft side of it at these last two races was really fun to me. You know, trying to kind of figure out a race weekend and how you're going to go about it, versus in the past where it's kind of just like, it's really easy to get overwhelmed.
Are there any particular kind of tools or techniques that you've been finding particularly useful from the work you've done?
Yeah, there's obviously some, I think the biggest thing is just, it's just been perspective. You know, I feel that I'm comfortable where I'm at as an athlete, as far as, you know, just like having, not like aside from results, but just the identity of myself, you know, the foundations of, my training, you know, kind of just the way I go about racing, you know, just kind of the effort that I put in, that sort of thing. So it's just, the biggest thing is kind of just been reflecting on who I am as an athlete, and keeping good perspective on everything.
Yeah.
Trying to, at least.
Yeah. Do you think your faith helps with that at all?
Yeah, absolutely. That's one of the biggest things for me as an athlete. And like I said, kind of going back to identity as a person, like I'm very thankful that racing isn't, you know, it isn't all me. It's just something that I do. And at the end of the day, you know, regardless of how finals pan out, I'm loved and I'm a child of God, and I'm very thankful for that. And it's really cool that throughout my career, that's some of the moments of my career have been hands down, like the most in tune I've been with God. And a lot of the big kind of, I guess, jumps per se, you could say, performance wise in my career, I've felt that he's been behind it and fully believe that it's his plan working out. And so that's given me huge confidence in the fact that, you know, there's a bigger picture for sure. And like I said, at the end of the day, I can rest assured that I'm loved, and there's more to me than just a Charlie Harrison mountain bike racer.
Awesome. Yeah, it sounds like you're in an awesome place, man. Right, well, we've got four final questions that we ask everyone. So we're going to wrap up with those, if that's all right with you.
Yep.
Cool. Well, the first one of those, if our listeners had $200 to improve their performance on a bike, what would you recommend they go and spend it on?
Oh my gosh. $200, I'd say probably go for a set of tires that matches whatever terrain you're riding on. I feel like that's one of the biggest things to being comfortable on a bike.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Have you got like a go-to set of tires for like your, let's say, for your kind of trail bike riding?
Yeah, for sure. So we're on Bontrager as a team. They've been super cool with me sort of riding some other tires trying to kind of help them, you know, push their tires. So it's been good. I've got quite a range of tires that I've been riding, but yeah, for sure. Like I've got, a tire set up that, you know, if it's dry and dusty and hard packed, like here at home, like that's going to be the go-to tire setup.
What would that be?
Oh, I probably shouldn't name it.
Okay. Fair enough. And what about on the downhill bike? Are you running the Bontrager tires on that?
Yeah, I ran those tires pretty much all year last year. They're working on a new set of mud tires as well. I actually haven't ridden those. Recent Kate have done some testing on those. But yeah, pretty much last year it was just G5s, and that's just a great tire for everything, really. And then we were using Dirty Dan's as our mud tire setup since we didn't have any 29 DH mud tires.
Got you. Okie dokes. Cool. Second question. If you could wind back the clock and sit down with yourself age 16, what advice would you give him?
Probably just not place so much emphasis on your own time schedule that you put on yourself. I know it's really easy personally for me. Throughout my career, there was a lot of things where I was like, right, like I want to do this by then. I want to be getting these results, that sort of thing. And, you know, being faith-based, that was, you know, God's plan was much, I'm so much more thankful that it worked out in the way he's worked it out versus, you know, what you think is the right way to do it and how everything should go. But like I said, I would just, yeah, just don't be so focused on the timestamp that you put on things. At the end of the day, God's plan is much better than humans. And yeah,
fair play. All right, third question. If you could have a coaching session from anyone, who would it be and what would you want to learn?
I'd probably go for a surf with John Florence. And okay. I'd have so many questions for him. Surfing's surfing's my biggest passion outside of cycling, so it would just try to be as much of a sponge as I could be.
Excellent. Cool. And then the last one, what do you do every day that you feel benefits you?
Get up early.
How early are we talking?
Well, I can't say every day. Last year it was pretty much every day, but now I've kind of been on a schedule where it's been like two on, one off. But just getting up at 5:30 and getting coffee going. And I'm not like one of those people that can like wake up, throw clothes on and go. I like my morning routine. So I'll get up early, make coffee, and then watch surf edits, kind of write out the day's plan, that sort of thing. And then get to, you know, whatever training is required for the day. But yeah, that's, I love getting up early and having a cup of coffee before the day kind of gets going.
Yeah. Does that mean you go to bed early at the other end of the day or not?
Yeah, I'm typically in bed at 8:30. I try and get to bed 8:15, 8:30, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So if I sleep's huge for me, so if I don't get enough sleep, it'll just compound on itself and I'll end up getting sick. So obviously I need to make sure that I try and get that at least 9 hours of sleep a night. But yeah, getting up early is worth going to bed early for me. I don't like going to bed early for sure. But getting up early is something that I really enjoy. Especially in the winter. It sucks now because in summer here in California, it's like it's light at pretty much like 5:20. But I love in the winter where you can get up and have coffee in the dark and watch the sun go up slowly.
Cool, man. Do you feel like you're getting ahead of your competition, sort of imagining them still in bed? Or is it just like you enjoy having that quiet time?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's like trying to get an edge on my competition or anything. I do like the fact that you're obviously going to get to your first training session or only training session of the day earlier, and then you'll have the rest of the day to kind of do whatever you wanted. So, you know, for me, it's like once training's done, I'm like, all right, let's check the waves, go for a surf. But I think the biggest thing for sure is just having that quiet time and chilling out. Watching surf edits is huge for me. That's pretty much every morning, coffee, watch some surf edits, just get psyched for the day.
Excellent. Good stuff. Well, all right. We're going to wrap up, but if people want to follow you throughout what's left of the 2020 season and into next year, where's the best place for them to head?
Yeah. Just Instagram at Charlie_Harrison_. I'm pretty terrible at social media, but that is my account.
Excellent. Cool. We'll put that in the show notes so people can find it.
Well, thanks, dude.
Yeah, it's been super interesting chatting. Hopefully we get some World Cup racing towards the end of the season so that you can take that great form that you're in and put it on the track and see how it goes.
Yeah, I'm pretty confident that at this point I feel like I'm just focusing on world champs. Just that I feel like that seems to be like the most concrete thing that we could that's going to happen this year. But I'm pretty positive that we'll get some racing in for sure to some extent. Nice one.
Cool. Well, I've got accommodation and transport booked for Leah Gang. So if it happens, I'll see you there.
Heck yeah. Looking forward to meet you in person.
Nice one. Cheers, Charlie.
Yeah. Thanks for your time, man. Have a good night.
All right. That's it for this episode with Charlie. I hope you've enjoyed listening. A massive thanks to Smith Optics and Canyon for supporting this episode. Don't forget that to be in with a chance of winning a pair of awesome Smith Ruckus riding glasses, all you need to do is to follow at Downtime Podcast and at Smith Optics over on Instagram. Head there, check out the competition post, and let me know why you need some new sunglasses in the comments. I'll be choosing a winner on Tuesday the 25th. Also, don't forget that as a Downtime listener, you can get free bike guard globally on all Canyon Gravity bikes until the end of August. All you need to do is to use the code DOWNTIME2020 at the checkout. That's Downtime, all in capitals, followed by the number 2020 with no spaces. That offer is valid on Spectral, Strive, Torque and Sender. Head to canyon.com and get involved. The terms and conditions for the offer, along with all the links you need, are in the show notes for this episode on downtimepodcast.com. If you fancy a new t-shirt, then head over to downtimepodcast.com/shop, where you can pick yourself up some new threads and help support the podcast at the same time. Keep on telling your riding friends about the podcast, keep sharing the episodes on your social media, and generally being awesome supporters of the show. This podcast is for you, so it's always great to see and hear that you're enjoying it. All right, we've got another awesome episode coming up soon, but until then, get out and ride.